Welcome to the deep dive. Today's mission is, well, it's a really big one. We are going to completely rewire how you approach the modern job market.
We really are. It's a total paradigm shift.
Yeah, exactly. Whether you are, you know, actively looking for a new role right now, or maybe you're just passively curious about what's out there, or you just want to understand the current landscape, I promise you're going to get some major aha moments today.
Oh, absolutely.
We're pulling from this really comprehensive new 2026 book and system on career transition. And our ultimate goal here is to extract a practical shortcut, basically, for navigating a hiring system that, frankly, feels fundamentally broken to a lot of people right now.
It really does feel like a maze these days. I mean, it is incredibly frustrating for job seekers. And that brings us to the foundational mindset shift of this entire framework.
Right.
The core philosophy here is simple, but for a lot of professionals, it is a really tough pill to swallow. And that is, the job hunt is not about you.
Wow. Yeah, that is tough to hear.
It is. It is entirely about the value you bring to an employer. The modern hiring system, you know, complete with these heavy AI filters, the endless automated portals, and the very real phenomenon of ghosting after three rounds of interviews.
Ugh, the ghosting is the worst.
Right. It isn't fair. It just isn't. But simply complaining about that unfairness doesn't change your employment status. Understanding how to play the game does.
Okay, let's unpack this. Starting with the very first week, someone finds themselves suddenly unemployed because the reading points out this massive, highly psychological trap that almost everyone falls into.
The panic apply.
Yes, the panic apply. Imagine the scenario, right? You lose your job on a Tuesday, you frantically update your resume on Wednesday, and by Friday evening, you have blast applied to 50 different jobs online.
Which feels great in the moment.
It feels incredibly productive. But apparently, it's actually the exact opposite of what you should be doing.
It is the ultimate illusion of progress. That spray and pray method of applying is essentially a coping mechanism for the sheer anxiety of job loss.
That makes so much sense.
You want to feel like you are taking control of a chaotic situation. But what you are actually doing is sending highly generic applications to roles you haven't properly researched for companies you don't truly understand.
Right.
And then, 3 weeks later, when you hear absolutely nothing back from any of those 50 portals, you start internalizing it. You start wondering what is inherently wrong with you or your career history.
And what's wrong isn't you at all, it's the raw math. I mean, there is a truly brutal statistic in the material from a 2026 Hunter study.
Oh, the conversion data.
Yes. They tracked roughly 1.4 million job applications across more than 60,000 candidates to see what actually works.
The numbers are staggering.
They really are. The conversion rate for applications submitted directly through LinkedIn, it is just 3.1%.
Wow.
Right. That means if you apply to 100 jobs on LinkedIn, you might get 3 initial screening interviews. Applying exclusively on job boards is essentially choosing to play the career game on hard mode.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it explains why that math is so punishing. Think of the modern job market like an iceberg.
Okay, an iceberg.
Job boards represent the tip of the iceberg. That's the 20% of open roles that everyone can see. The other 80% is entirely underwater.
The hidden job market.
Exactly. That's the hidden job market. The data has been remarkably consistent on this for years. Somewhere between 70 to 80% of all jobs are filled through networking, internal referrals, and direct approaches.
So it never even hits the job board.
Right. It is the manager who realizes they need help on a project and asks their team, hey, do you know anyone good at project management? Before HR even has a chance to draft a formal job description.
By the time a job is posted publicly on that tip of the iceberg, you are joining a queue of thousands.
Exactly.
Which is exactly why that week one panic applying is such a massive drain on your energy. Instead, the author gives a very practical, if unglamorous, foundation for your first week.
You have to sort out your personal logistics first.
Yes. File for unemployment immediately. Do not let pride or a sense of stigma stop you. You have paid into that safety net your entire working life.
It's your money.
It is. And figure out your interim health care or COBRA insurance options so you aren't caught completely off guard if something happens. And crucially, if your former employer offered outplacement support, use it.
People ignore that all the time.
They do, usually because they're in shock or they're just angry at the company. But that is free resume review, career counseling, and interview coaching. Leave absolutely no money or resources on the table.
Because you simply cannot think strategically about a career pivot If you are lying awake panicking at 3 a.m. about how you're going to pay the mortgage or handle a medical bill.
You have to stabilize the foundation.
Exactly. You stabilize your personal foundation before you even attempt to build the house of your next career move.
Okay, so once that foundation is set, we move to the dreaded resume. And here is a reality check that stings. Human hiring managers spend roughly 15 seconds looking at a resume.
Barely enough time to skim the bold text.
Right. And that is a big if. That's if it actually gets past the Automated Applicant Tracking System, or ATS, in the first place.
The gatekeeper.
Yeah. Because of that incredibly tight window, the author draws a massive line in the sand between listing duties and listing achievements. I know this trips a lot of people up. Can you break down the difference?
It is where 90% of resumes fail. A duty is simply what you are expected to do.
Yeah.
An achievement is what actually happened because you did it well.
Give me an example.
Let's look at an example. Your resume might say, managed customer accounts. That is a duty. It tells the employer absolutely nothing about whether you are actually good at managing them.
You could have been terrible at it.
Exactly. You just held the seat. An achievement says, grew key customer accounts by 30% over 12 months. The difference is the measurable impact.
I love that.
Employers fundamentally do not care what you were broadly responsible for. They care about what you accomplished while holding that responsibility.
This brings us to a concept I absolutely love from the reading, the so what test.
Oh, it's brilliant.
It's the ultimate filter for your resume. You need to read every single bullet point on your document and your LinkedIn profile and ask yourself, so what?
Right.
For example, I managed a team of 12. So what? Did they hit their sales targets? I implemented a new inventory system. So what? Did it save the company time or money?
If you can't answer it, cut it.
Exactly. If a bullet point doesn't answer the so what question with some kind of measurable impact or specific result, it gets cut entirely. It is just taking up valuable real estate.
What's fascinating here is how often people actively push back on this concept. They will say, but I don't have any achievements. I'm just mediocre. I just showed up and did my job.
I hear that all the time.
It is a huge psychological block for a lot of professionals, mm-hmm. especially those in administrative or support roles.
Yeah.
But if you have held a job for any length of time and haven't been fired, you have achievements.
You just don't see them?
You are just too close to the daily grind to see them. The reading offers a brilliant thought experiment to excavate this hidden value.
Mm-hmm.
You ask yourself, if you disappeared tomorrow, what would fall apart?
That is such a great way to reframe it.
It completely changes your perspective.
Mm-hmm.
If you just vanished, what would stop getting done? What literal or figurative fires would suddenly start burning across the office?
I guess a lot of people don't realize how much weight they carry.
Right. Maybe you think you just handled the department scheduling. But in reality, you are the only reason the entire logistics team hasn't ground to a complete halt.
Wow. Yeah.
Holding complex things together, maintaining an error-free environment, retaining difficult clients, those are massive achievements. Finding that hidden value is how you shift your internal mindset from just doing my job to delivering measurable results.
But let's say you do the work. You have those amazing achievement-based bullet points. You still have to get them past the algorithm.
The ATS.
The ATS is the ultimate gatekeeper today. The framework is very clear. You have to beat the machine before you can even hope to impress the human.
Which means stripping it down.
Yes, utilizing incredibly simple formatting.
Yeah.
No tables, no fancy text boxes, no graphics or headshots.
They look great to a human eye.
But they often turn into complete unreadable gibberish when the parsing software tries to read them. You also have to mirror the employer's exact language. If their job description asks for stakeholder management and your resume says you worked with internal teams, you have to change it.
It is the exact same skill.
It is. But the machine might not make the semantic connection.
Translation is critical. You have to speak the machine's language first. And of course, when we talk about algorithms in 2026, we have to talk about AI.
Yeah, we can't ignore that.
AI is fundamentally changing the mechanics of the job search, but it has to be treated as an assistant. Not a replacement for your own critical thinking.
Because recruiters can tell.
Recruiters and hiring managers can spot raw AI output instantly now. That generic, overly polished, perfectly symmetrical text, what industry folks are calling AI slop, goes straight into the reject pile.
AI slop. I love that term.
It signals to the employer that you couldn't even be bothered to put in the basic effort to write to them.
Oh, absolutely. If your cover letter starts with, I am thrilled to apply for this dynamic position and leverage my synergistic skills to propel your paradigm forward.
Right into the trash.
Exactly. Everyone knows a bot wrote it in about 2 seconds.
This raises an important question regarding what the author called the AI accountability gap. We are navigating a system where algorithms are increasingly doing the heavy lifting, filtering candidates, scoring asynchronous video interviews, and parsing resumes.
Right.
But these systems often inherit historical biases from the datasets they were trained on.
Wait, if there's no transparency in these systems, how do we even know we're being filtered out by a biased algorithm and not just a recruiter having a bad day?
That is exactly the core issue. You don't know.
Wow.
These models are often trained on a company's historical hiring data. If a particular department historically hired mostly people from a specific university or a specific demographic profile, the algorithm simply recognizes that pattern as successful.
It's just replicating the past.
Exactly. It's doing math based on past data. The truly frustrating part for you, as the applicant, is the total lack of a feedback loop. When an algorithm rejects you, you just get a generic automated email.
We regret to inform you.
Yes. There's no appeal process. You can't reach out and say, hey, your bot misread my career trajectory.
Yeah.
You are essentially competing against invisible criteria.
It is incredibly frustrating, but it is the reality of the landscape. So how do you actually beat the bot?
You use it.
Right. The approach here is to use AI to your advantage, but carefully. You use it for brainstorming those hidden achievements we just talked about.
It's great for that.
It is. You use it to prep for interviews by having it analyze a specific job description and predict the exact questions they might ask you. You do not use it to write generic cover letters or auto-apply. You want your material to sound like you, just a sharper, more focused version of you.
Because if every single candidate is using AI to smooth out their applications into identical corporate speak, then sounding like a real, authentic human being suddenly becomes your competitive advantage.
That's a great point.
It helps you stand out in a sea of perfection.
Which brings us to the real engine of the job search. The thing that actually taps into that hidden iceberg and gets you hired. Targeted networking.
And here again, we need a massive mindset shift. Most job seekers treat networking like they are begging for a favor.
Yeah, asking for a coffee chat.
They approach it hat in hand, apologizing for taking up someone's time. But networking is fundamentally a business transaction between equals.
Say more about that.
You have highly specific skills and abilities. Employers have money and problems that desperately need solving. You're simply exploring whether there is a mutual alignment.
Right.
When you approach it from that footing, as a consultant exploring a fit, you stop sounding desperate and start sounding like a professional.
Okay, so let's say I've landed the coffee chat. My instinct is to slide my newly polished resume across the table. But the reading says that is a terrible idea. Why?
Because a resume is a highly targeted document designed to get you hired for a specific, currently open job. If you hand someone a resume tailored for a senior marketing director role, and they don't happen to have that exact job open today, they literally don't know what to do with it.
It's useless to them.
It just goes in a drawer. What you want to use here instead is a one-page networking bio.
This was a huge light bulb moment for me.
It's a game changer.
It really is. The one-page bio summarizes your core strengths, your overarching career trajectory, and specifically what your target companies or roles are. It is a marketing document, not a legal record of your employment.
Exactly.
It makes it incredibly easy for your contact to understand your broad value proposition and forward it to the right people.
Making it remarkably easy for people to help you is the entire secret to successful networking. If you sit down and say, hey, let me know if you hear of anything out there.
Oh, I've said that so many times.
We all have. But they will forget you by the time they finish their latte. Anything is not an actionable request.
So what is actionable? The golden question. The author emphasizes that there is one specific question you must ask at the very end of every single 20-minute informational interview.
Write this down.
Yes, write this down. Who else do you think I should be talking to?
It is brilliant because you aren't putting them on the spot by asking them for a job. You are simply asking for introductions.
Which is much easier to give.
Yes. That is how your network compounds exponentially. You talk to five people. They each introduce you to two more people in their field, and suddenly you have reached hiring managers deep inside that hidden job market that you would never have found on a public board.
To guide those conversations, you also need a target list. The framework recommends organizing a specific list of 30 to 50 target companies.
Right. Divide it up.
Exactly. You break them down into A, B, and C tiers. The A list are your absolute dream jobs, and the C list are your viable backups. You literally bring this list to your networking meeting so people can scan it visually and say, oh, wow, my neighbor actually works at one of those A-list companies. Let me introduce you.
It gives them a visual prompt.
Yes. But building this list and reaching out requires cold messaging strangers on platforms like LinkedIn. And that genuinely terrifies people.
It does. It feels deeply uncomfortable to reach out to a second-degree connection out of the blue. But the text offers the what's the downside rule to overcome that fear.
I really like this rule.
Imagine you are agonizing over sending a 5-minute message to someone you admire in your industry. Ask yourself, what is the actual realistic downside if it goes poorly?
They just don't reply.
They don't reply. Or they say no. That's it. You are in the exact same position you were in 5 minutes ago.
Yep.
The risk of doing nothing is always fundamentally greater than the risk of doing something imperfectly.
Okay, so you've optimized your materials, you've networked your way past the AI gatekeepers, you've worked your target list, and you've landed the interview. Let's talk about acing it, because the actual logistics of interviewing have structurally changed post-COVID.
Dramatically so. Candidates often panic because hiring cycles are now stretching out for weeks, sometimes even months.
It feels like they're ghosting you.
Right. They assume the company is stringing them along or interviewing better candidates. But the reality is often pure logistics. Before 2020, HR would block out a conference room for a Tuesday and cycle candidates through 5 in-person interviews back to back.
I remember those days.
Now, they are trying to coordinate 5 different virtual video interviews across 5 different busy executives' remote calendars across multiple time zones.
It's a nightmare.
It takes weeks. It's not necessarily a lack of interest. It's calendar gridlock.
That is incredibly good to know, so you don't lose your mind waiting by the phone. Now, when you are finally in those virtual interviews, you are inevitably going to face behavioral questions.
Always.
Tell me about a time when you failed, or tell me about a time you managed conflict. To answer these without rambling, the author breaks down the BARL method, B-A-R-L.
A great framework.
It stands for background, action, result, and crucially, learning. Background sets the scene quickly. Action is what you specifically did to solve the problem, not what your team did. Result is the quantified outcome. But I want to focus on that L. Why is the learning phase the secret weapon here?
Because the learning component is what separates a merely good candidate from a great one. Anyone can describe a time they put out a massive fire at work.
Right.
But when you take the extra step to explain what you learned from that crisis, what systems you put in place to ensure it never happened again, and how you would handle it differently today with the benefit of hindsight.
You're showing growth.
You are actively proving your self-awareness to the hiring manager. You are demonstrating that you are an evolving professional who learns from mistakes rather than someone who just survives them. That trait is incredibly rare.
Speaking of self-awareness, let's tackle the dreaded weakness question. What is your biggest weakness?
Oh, everyone hates this one.
If you give the classic fake answers like, I'm a perfectionist, or I just care too much and work too hard, the interviewer is internally rolling their eyes. It's a cliche.
It is worse than a cliche. It shows you think you're too clever to actually answer the question honestly.
Yeah.
The framework provides a very clear formula for a genuine answer. First, share a real professional weakness. The author uses the example of struggling to delegate early in his career because he wanted to control the quality of everything.
Which is very relatable.
Second, explain exactly how you manage it today. Maybe you took management training or you instituted a specific check-in system with your team.
Showing you addressed it.
Third, and this is the most important part, admit that it isn't magically cured. You acknowledge that you still have to actively fight the instinct to micromanage when project deadlines get tight.
Wow, just owning it.
Exactly. That level of honesty shows immense maturity and trustworthiness.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Let's say you nail the behavioral questions, they love you, and we finally get to the money. The salary game.
The most stressful part.
For sure. The reading lays out a golden rule of salary negotiation. Whoever mentions a number first loses their leverage.
It is an ironclad rule in negotiation. Your entire objective during the interview process is to delay the salary conversation until after they have firmly decided you are the singular candidate they want.
Why is that so critical?
If you throw out a number early on, you are anchoring yourself. If your number is too low, you leave thousands of dollars on the table. If it's too high, you might get screened out by HR before the hiring manager even realizes the true depth of your value.
But wait, won't the recruiter just get incredibly annoyed if I keep dodging the question? You don't want to start off the relationship by seeming evasive or difficult to work with.
It is a totally valid fear, but it's all about your delivery. You aren't stonewalling them, you are politely shifting the focus. You simply use a deflection strategy.
How does that sound in practice?
When they ask for your expectations, you volley it right back with a smile. You say, "I'm really focused on finding the right fit first. But what is the approved salary range for this position?"
It's so simple, but it forces them to reveal their hand first.
Always.
The book shares an amazing real-world anecdote about a client named John who used this exact strategy. John was pushed hard by a recruiter on his salary expectations, but he held his ground, stayed polite, and waited for the employer to name the price first.
It takes nerve.
It does, because he refused to anchor himself to his previous lower salary at a smaller company. The new employer eventually offered a starting number that was way higher than he would have ever dared to ask for.
That happens so often.
He effectively negotiated an extra $16,000 onto his base salary just by having the discipline to wait for them to speak first.
It perfectly illustrates the point that your past salary has absolutely nothing to do with your current market value.
Say that again.
Your past salary has nothing to do with your current value. You are negotiating based entirely on the value you are bringing to the new employer's specific problems, not what your old employer managed to get away with paying you.
So, what does this all mean? Let's bring it home. You've negotiated the offer, you've signed the papers, you survived the transition. The material briefly touches on the crucial first 90 days on the job.
The onboarding phase.
Yeah. The biggest mistake new hires make is trying to prove their worth on day one by aggressively trying to change everything. Instead, your first 90 days should be heavily focused on listening.
Absorb everything.
Understand the hidden culture. Find small, low-risk, quick wins to build credibility with your new team, and always, always clarify your boss's expectations in writing so there is absolutely no misalignment down the road.
That paper trail is essential.
So to recap our core theme today, job hunting is not about begging for a paycheck. It is about finding the exact intersection between what you do best and what an employer desperately needs solved. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive.
And as we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over, building on everything we've discussed about the current hiring landscape.
Let's hear it.
If we truly live in a world where AI tools are relentlessly smoothing out everyone's resumes, cover letters, and communications into perfectly polished, identical corporate speak, does that mean your slight human awkwardness, your unique conversational quirks, and your unpolished authenticity are about to become the most valuable premium assets in the future job market?